Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. The subject of our program is the regional magazine Adirondack Life. Regional magazines describe and promote life and recreation in a particular geographic area. The Adirondack Park was created by the state of New York in 1892. The park encompasses approximately 6 million acres, nearly half of which is public land, and is constitutionally protected to remain forever wild forest preserve. The remaining half of the park is private land, which includes settlements, farms, timberlands, businesses, homes, and camps. This mix of public and private land is essential to the character of the Adirondacks and is reflected in the content of Adirondack Life magazine. Adirondack Life's first issue was published in winter 1970. Before that, it was a special section to a local newspaper published by Robert Hall, who went on to be editor of The Conservationist. Adirondack Life started as a quarterly, then was published bimonthly, and is now published in 8 issues a year. Adirondack Life's circulation is almost 50,000, with many subscribers in New York, but it has subscribers worldwide. This colorful, visually appealing magazine runs about 90 pages per issue. Articles are richly illustrated with colorful photographs. As one would expect, the magazine covers vacation destinations, upcoming events, regional history, and wildlife. But the content reaches beyond the expected. The December 2006 issue has articles about how very few people of color visit the Adirondacks, a cable TV channel that broadcasts continuous live video of a bridge, and an Elvis impersonator who plays Kirk in an amateur version of Star Trek. Advertisements for Adirondack-style furniture and decorations, vacation opportunities, real estate, and other Adirondack-related goods and services fill many of the pages. To learn more about Adirondack Life, my guest is the magazine's creative director, Betsy Folwell. So, Betsy, welcome to Periodical Radio. First, tell us what you do as creative director of Adirondack Life.
Well, at a lot of magazines, creative director is involved in day-to-day things like photo shoots and, you know, managing how the magazine looks. And I leave that up to the editors and the art director. My overview is really the whole creative side, the art director, the editors, advertising, production, printing, like everything that goes into the magazine that you see physically is under my supervision. So it's kind of broader. And in other places, you know, the publisher does that as well as circulation and, you know, the financing. But our management is such that it's a three-part team. The circulation director is, you know, part of the publishing team, and our controller is part of the publishing team. So we've divided up the work differently than it is at other magazines.
I see. Betsy, in preparation for this show, you described Adirondack Life to me as a true four-color magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe for us what that means and what it takes to publish in color?
Sure. I think that's what most people think of when they're, you know, thinking about Adirondack Life is great photographs. And that's really been our hallmark for, you know, more than 20 years, a long time. And luckily, there are a lot of people photographing the Adirondacks who are, you know, excellent. Nathan Farb, Carl Heilman, Mark Bowie, Nancy Battaglia. I mean, really, there are just dozens of great photographers, and there's a whole new generation of photographers coming up, like Drew Haas, and people who are, you know, kind of, they've taken their love of backcountry adventure, like backcountry skiing and hiking and canoeing, and added photography to it. So they're going a lot of places that other people haven't gone with good equipment. So, you know, we're lucky in that regard. So producing a four-color magazine means that, you know, we've encouraged color to exist on every single page, and that trickles down to advertising. We want our ads to look great because, you know, prettier ad entices somebody to buy a product. And, you know, tints and different colors, beautiful pictures, even if they're tiny, I mean, that's what we're looking for. Is the magazine is it's very visual. It's not like The Economist. Our goal is to make it something that people flip through. They're attracted because it's colorful and interesting and vivid, and then they start reading because the headlines grab their attention or they recognize an author's name, and they take it from there.
How has the work of preparing a four-color magazine changed over the years?
Oh, my God. It's changed so drastically. You know, the original Adirondack Life, published in the 1970s, was on this kind of, it was on stiff paper, and you'd recognize the sort of pebbly texture from newsletters of that era. And in those days, if you wanted to print a photograph, you had to send it to a company that did a separation from the transparency, and they would create pieces of film in four different colors that, if printed separately, like a magenta ink, a cyan, that's blue, and then a yellow ink, and black, those would make all colors of the rainbow, depending on what percentage of each ink is used. We don't do color separations anymore. That whole process has become digitized. The same work is done as far as separating the colors, but it happens through a series of computers that are telling the printing press what color inks to squirt out. And for the type side, in the old days, I mean, in the old days, printers set each piece of type, every letter, and then there were linotype machines. And then there were things called compugraphic machines, which created this long roll of photographic paper that was basically photographs of type. And those would get covered with hot wax and stuck to a board and then photographed with an enormous stationary camera. And now, you know, it's all created on computers with desktop publishing. The whole thing of moving text and pictures and illustrations and all this stuff around, you know, that's just a matter of moving your cursor and your mouse. In the old days, you were using an X-Acto knife and hot wax to create the same effect, and a lot of the effects simply weren't possible.
That is quite the change. Computers have affected our work in many, many ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, golly, I'd say probably 12 years ago, Adirondack Life had one Macintosh computer for desktop publishing. And I cannot estimate how many computers we have in the building now. I mean, each editor has one. The art director has one. There are, you know, scanners everywhere, different kinds of proofing equipment. We create our own color proofs in-house. And our scanner costs about as much as a new car. So, you know, we're doing a lot of stuff in-house that used to happen at a pre-press house or at a print shop.
Are many of your photographers now going digital? Are the original photographs in digital format?
Many of them are. There's a real caveat to that. You know, if you take your digital camera into the field, you have a viewfinder that's, you know, 2 by 2 inches. So some people are going to the extent of taking their laptops with them. So they're composing the picture on the screen of the laptop, which is much bigger. But the files they're creating, still, most of them don't have the clarity of, say, a 4x5 transparency. And if you look at the Adirondack Life calendar that uses pictures that are 11 by 13, you know, a lot of those are larger format images that we're using. If you took a 35 millimeter slide, you know, the little guys, and blew that up to 11 by 13, you're going up 1,200%, so you're going to lose some detail. And that's one of the problems with digital photography is the not a lot of people have the extremely high-end cameras that can hold, you know, file an image with that much information in it.
I see.
Yeah, without getting too technical, there's a whole new movement in digital photography called RAW, which enables you to save a lot more details, and in the end, you can manipulate a lot more aspects of the picture, but it's just, these files are massive. and hard to move around. I mean, you can't email a raw picture of any size to your grandmother.
Because the file size is too
large. Yeah, I mean, just too darn big.
Betsy, what's your personal standard for a well-produced issue of the magazine?
Well, we like to see a good geographic mix of stories. You know, the Adirondack Park is big. It stretches from, you know, Lion Mountain down to Old Forge and Cranberry Lake over to Lake George. And, you know, there's a lot of territory in between. So we hope that there's a story or a picture or something that appeals to people in different parts of the park in every single issue. And sometimes that's hard. As we are based in the High Peaks. I live in Blue Mountain Lake, but, you know, the bias tends to be toward the High Peaks just because lots of great photography is coming out of there. So a geographic mix is a goal. The other thing is a real mix of stories. Something, you know, you can do as a reader, whether it's a cross-country ski trip or a canoe trip or a place to go you hadn't thought of. A history piece, some kind of bit of local lore that is unknown even to people from close by. Profiles of interesting people. You know, a little snapshot of a successful business that's making an interesting Adirondack product. You know, some politics, some environmental news, some nature. You know, all different things in the package. I mean, it's a conscious effort to bring in lots of different topics, because if we did only environmental issues or political issues, we'd really bore an awful lot of people who, you know, come to the magazine, you know, looking for something they can do.
I certainly wasn't expecting the article about the Elvis impersonator who plays Kirk in an amateur Star Trek production.
Well, hey, I mean, it's happening in an old car dealership outside Port Henry, and a lot of local people have thrown themselves into this project. And
that was a fun article.
Kind of exporting it to the world.
That was a fun article.
Yeah, that was for your listeners. I guess why don't you explain what you got out of it?
Well, one thinks of the Adirondacks as being, you know, wildlife and forever wild. I think that's what folks naturally think about first when they think of the Adirondacks. But I have been there enough to know that there is a wide variety of activities going on, and people live there. It's their home. And they have a wide variety of interests, just like people in any other part of the country do. And that was an interesting offbeat story about things that people do in the Adirondacks.
Well, I never really watched Star Trek, but, you know, these are grown adults who are filming, you know, Star Trek episodes that they've written and produced, and the production values are pretty good. And they have a full makeup studio, and they have costumes, and they have a mock bridge for the spaceship, and, I mean, it's really quite elaborate, and they're doing it because it's a project they love. It's kind of the next step in amateur theater, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Betsy, who are the readers of Adirondack Life?
Well, they are all over the place. First of all, we have readers in every state, but they are concentrated in New York and the Northeast. Maybe 10 or 15% of our readers live year-round in the Adirondacks. But lots of readers in the Albany, Schenectady, you know, whole capital district, Syracuse, Buffalo, Rochester, also Manhattan, Long Island, New Jersey, so on and so forth. So, you know, mostly in the Northeast, a few more men than women, like maybe 52% men. And I think partly that's because a lot more men experience the Adirondacks, you know, as scouts or, you know, hiking, rafting, whatever they were doing with their buddies at a certain age, and they've kind of held on to that interest. And the average reader age is just over 50, a very active 50, and they tend to spend about a month of the year here. You know, we do a reader survey every couple of years that's very exhaustive. And we ask people questions from, you know, did you buy a pair of binoculars this year, to what's your household income, to, you know, what are your favorite article topics? And typically their favorite topics are history. One of their favorite sections of the magazine is that back page called Our Towns, which profiles a different town in every issue. So we try to get that feedback every couple of years just to make sure we're satisfying our core group of readers.
Who are your writers?
Our writers are all over, too. Seriously, you know, there are a handful who are in the Adirondacks who are also writing for newspapers or working for public radio stations. But, you know, for bigger topics that involve a lot more research, we seek out pros who may live in the Hudson Valley or Vermont or, you know, even farther afield than that. You know, there's no geographic restriction on where a writer lives. Certainly it's, you know, if they're willing to come here and do the research, that's great.
Do you ever accept unsolicited manuscripts?
Oh, we see them. We see them all the time. And sometimes those are, you know, the happiest surprises of all. That's how we meet a lot of writers who come to write more regularly for us, just by sending in a really well-done short piece. Our guidelines are available online. If you go to AdirondackLife.com, you'll see on the left editorial guidelines is one of the links you can hit. And that spells out what we're looking for, because, you know, we don't publish poetry. We're not looking for articles less than 900 words. And it really helps if people are familiar with the magazine, because, you know, they can write a lovely story about, say, the Adirondack Blanket Company, but, gosh, that's in the current issue, so it pays to do your homework. You know, we love to hear from writers who have, you know, a specific area of expertise, like someone who's only done profiles or only written about botany or whatever, because to combine, you know, the skill of good writing with real knowledge of a science or social science or history, that's a huge plus. You know, a lot of journalists are generalists, and someone with that extra bit of background knows where to find primary sources or how to seek out experts in the field and can get to them. So those are good things.
As a regional magazine, how does Adirondack Life reflect the character of the region?
Well, that's one of the things that we, you know, we hope we do, and we're not always sure that we do it. But, for example, you know, we could not do a September-October issue without showing a photo feature of beautiful fall foliage. It's just expected. If it's not there, we intuitively know we've let people down. And, you know, after I've been there since 1989, so I've seen a lot of these fall foliage photo features, and it's like, oh man, enough already. But this is what people want and expect. You know, if they're living in you know, Florida, they want to see fall foliage in the fall, you know, even if it's on paper. So how does it reflect the region? Well, we try to keep in mind that the Adirondacks is not one place. It is wild country, you know, the forest preserve. It is towns, some interesting towns, and it's people doing everything from logging to goofing off doing a Star Trek movie. And it's funny, I'm sure one of the complaints is we're not reflecting, you know, oh, you know, the hardscrabble life that's here. But we don't want to project a picture that may be construed as demeaning or condescending. You know, that's a tough thing to do.
Sure. Betsy, you won an award from the International Regional Magazine Association for your Short Carries column. First, can you describe for our listeners what a short carry is?
Oh, sure. Other people may call it a portage. It's when you have to carry your canoe from one body of water to the next. And the editor's note in Adirondack Life has been called short carries for, I don't know, I would say probably 26, 27 years. I didn't come up with the title of it. And I've written really dozens of these columns. And I think the IRMA International Regional Magazine Award I got in September was the 6th for that column. So,
congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
What were the topics of some of those columns?
Well, I think that was my crime spree series. And not real typical, but there had been some... Well, I wrote about arson, which turns out to have a long history up here. Getting rid of, you know, derelict hotels when they've outlived their usefulness. And there's some sort of funny historical quotes about arson. And then, you know, more seriously, there were several buildings burned at the Adirondack League Club near Old Forge over the past few years. And as yet, you know, those cases haven't been solved. So it was about that kind of, that was the news end of it, these recent arsons. And the old bit, it's like, well, guess what, it's nothing new. Then another crime was the theft of a really amazing weather vane from a church in Crown Point. You know, beautiful piece of folk art that was the angel Gabriel with a trumpet. And what makes it special is the weather vane itself was made from local iron, you know, mined in town, and they knew which blacksmith had made it. A lot of times with folk art, all that information is lost, but this had a really excellent pedigree. And one night, somehow, somebody got up there and took it down and had a really nasty-looking plywood replica ready to go up, and I guess they got spooked and never put this plywood piece up. So in the morning, someone driving by saw this plywood thing, realized the staff holding the weather vane was gone. So that was another one. And so crime in general. Oh, and the other one in the series was embezzlement, because there were several cases of embezzling against town governments and fire companies over the last few years, and just kind of a roundup of, you know, that kind of thing. But typically the columns are more evocative of a season or a place. You know, how, for instance, Blue Mountain Lake, when it's frozen, sort of turns into the Village Green. Places where people, you know, it's a place where people congregate that's no one's property. Great place to go on a sunny afternoon, and you'll find everybody out there doing all kinds of stuff, from ice fishing to skiing or walking dogs. So, yeah, a lot of the columns are just kind of evocative of life here, trying to set a tone and capture a mood, keep people interested if they're not in a place that has snow or ice or black flies or, you know, beautiful sunsets.
Can you tell us a little bit about the International Regional Magazine Association that gave you that award?
Yeah.
Who are its members, what its purpose is?
Sure. The International Regional Magazines Association has been around for more than 40 years. And members are magazines a lot of your listeners have heard of, like Arizona Highways, Down East from Maine, Texas Parks and Wildlife, Oklahoma, beautiful British Columbia, Saltscapes, which is the magazine for Maritime Canada, Chesapeake Bay, Vermont Life, North Carolina, really many, many states, Wisconsin Trails, Lake Country in Minnesota, Cottage Life in Canada. Many states or regions have regional magazines to promote what they're up to. And in a lot of states, the regional magazines are an arm of the tourism department, like in New Mexico. So, you know, these magazines get together once a year for a, you know, week-long seminar with programs on how to boost your subscriptions, the latest technology for Photoshopping pictures, printing technology, legal and copyright issues. So it's, you know, it's a professional organization, and the great thing about this group is we can share ideas freely without really competing for each other's readers and advertisers. In a lot of other professional organizations, yes, you can have a seminar, but once the seminar is over, people are scuffling for the same clients, and that's not the case with the IRMA people. Yeah, so we can trade back and forth ideas for products and approaches and cool things to do with your website, so it works out pretty well.
Very good. Betsy, with over 40,000 paid subscribers and a wide array of advertisers, it would seem that Adirondack Life is financially healthy. Is the future bright for the magazine?
You know, I think the future's bright for the magazine as long as the future is okay for the Adirondacks. And it's been interesting because, you know, since the 90s, there have been some kind of blips in the national economy, but the Adirondack economy has been pretty steady. There hasn't been spectacular growth, but it's been steady. So, you know, we reflect our growth. We haven't taken a lot of hits over the last few years. And I think as far as the outlook for the magazine, it's good. We're doing some things in 2007 to try to capture some new readers. We are, you know, coming out with some new products. You know, we published a beautiful 3-foot by 4-foot topographical map a few years ago. And we've turned that map into a jigsaw puzzle. The next step is a raised relief map of that, where you can actually feel the bumps that are the mountains and that kind of thing. So, you know, we're, along with boosting the circulation of the magazine, we're coming out with some new products. You know, we just launched an engagement calendar for 2007, you know, a week at a glance with, you know, 53 beautiful pictures. And, you know, we'll do another engagement calendar with historical pictures in 2008. So, you know, a lot of projects on the side that people might not associate with Adirondack Life immediately, but things that, you know, broaden our brand and keep people engaged in the name anyway.
Betsy Folwell, thank you very much for being my guest on Periodical Radio. It's been fascinating.
Well, thank you for asking, and keep reading.
I will.
Okay.
Annual subscriptions to Adirondack Life are $24.95. To subscribe, write to Adirondack Life, P.O. Box 410, J, New York, 12941, or contact them online at AdirondackLife.com. Thank you for listening to this installment of Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.